So this is number 13, the Lamb and the Scroll with the Seven Seals. We are discussing Revelation chapter 5 today, the Scroll and the Lamb. So it continues really the scene that was set in chapter 4, which we discussed last week. It's the throne room scene. And there's a being on the scene. And if you recall, the being on the throne, there were 24 thrones around the main throne, and there were 24 elders. And at the close of chapter 4, they were all worshiping and giving praise to this being on the primary throne. And so it continues. Then I saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep loudly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, "Weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." And between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain, with seven horns and with seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And he went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne. And when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayer of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation, and you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth." Then I looked, and I heard around the throne and the living creatures and the elders the voice of many angels, numbering myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." And I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them saying, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever." And the four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshipped. I think as we contemplate and ponder these two chapters, chapter 4 and chapter 5, we need to keep in mind that this is set up as a drama, as a theater. It's very stylized and theatrical description. It's not a literal description of heaven. Now, we need to imagine a stage. In a play, in a theater, everything is somewhat exaggerated. And we need to realize that that's what's happening here. In chapter 5, the Lamb is the central actor. Everything, all the events leading up to it and following it, center and focus on the Lamb. The throne is where the action takes place. Now, the Lamb is the central action. The throne is the central prop of this stage. Although God is never really named, we presume He is the being that is seated on the throne. This scroll then contains perhaps what must take place after this, that John is told about at the very beginning of this scene as it opens in chapter 4, verse 1. And so this is why John weeps when at first no one is found to be able to open it. Well, if the scroll cannot be opened, this drama ends. And what was promised to John cannot take place. No one in heaven, on earth, or below is able to open it or even to look into it. This heaven, earth, and below are the three classic realms: the spirit realm, the physical realm, the realm of the dead. So it is talking about the universe and time in its totality, space and time. This scroll can only be opened by a being who is worthy. Towards the end of chapter 4 and verse 11, the song proclaims God to be worthy, but this God, the being on the throne, does not open it. He's the creator, the source, perhaps you might say, of the scroll. And so he's not the one that is going to open it. In other words, someone equal to God, someone else equal to God, is the only being who is going to be able to open the scroll. As the scene continues, the Lamb is worthy because he has conquered whatever it is that he has conquered. It's of interest that the Lamb simply appears amidst the four creatures and elders, and it doesn't come from off stage or anything. It just seems to appear. You might think of a stage play in which, below the floor of the stage, all of a sudden, all these actors are in the middle of the stage, and as they part away, see all of a sudden where there was nothing, you see this Lamb. Yeah. It's the first significant action in this act. Because up to this point, what's been all the characters, all the actors, everything has been present from as the curtains open. But this Lamb is the first new element, really, to appear. And we see that in this description of the scene, the creatures and the elders worship the Lamb in the same manner as they did the one on the throne. So we know from that the two are equal. Two are equal in authority and power. A new song is introduced, so presumably this new song that's being sung, it has never been sung prior to the action of the Lamb in the scene. And as the setup of this scene continues, more beings join in the song. The angels first, and every creature on heaven, earth, and sea. And sea is often understood in the classical literature and thought to represent the underworld as well. So, no being found in heaven and on earth and in the underworld, and then all beings joining heaven, earth, and sea. Can understand these realms to be basically to be the same. It's representing the totality of time and space. And the scene of worship continues. Jesus is God and receives worship together with God. So that's kind of some thoughts that I had as I went through it the first time. Any comments or questions, thoughts about this scene before we continue further?
It's interesting that they set up the fact that there's the lamb was slain, and by your blood you're ransomed for people, for God, every tribe, every language, every people, every nation. He sets up a kind of an aspect that no matter the person period, that they have this opportunity with the grace. It's kind of the first time, well, I don't know if it's the first time, but it's kind of a bold first saying that I've heard of that it's just like there's no beating around the bush, just that's the pure and simple fact. Okay.
All right, well, continuing on, then, some background. Legal documents were sealed, often with seven seals imprinted with the attestations of seven witnesses. The wax seals would have to be broken to loose the strings beneath them, which wrapped the scroll and guaranteed that it had not been opened and thus altered. So this idea of a scroll with seven seals is, you know, not unique at all to Revelation. It's just common... a common way in which legal documents were handled. This form was used for contract deeds and wills. It became increasingly common in Roman documents of this period, and some Palestinian Jewish documents of this sort have been recovered. Scrolls were normally written on only one side of a papyrus sheet, reserving the outside for the title or address. But this scroll is particularly full and written on both sides. The writing side was called the recto, where the fibers were horizontal and easier for writing. The verso was used only when the recto had inadequate space. Documents written on both sides are rare enough to have a technical name, an opsithograph. We can know from that maybe hadn't been obvious in prior readings of this passage is that this scroll is very full. Whatever is contained in it cannot fit onto just the usual side for writing. Both sides contain writing. Continuing, although Revelation is full of sevens, it may be significant that Roman wills were normally sealed with seven seals. Seals on legal documents guarantee that no one had opened or tampered with them. A will could not be opened until the death of the person whose will it was could be attested. If a will is in view here, it is significant that it is the Lamb who has been slain who is worthy to open it. And continues, the book may well be the Lamb's book of life. At any rate, under Roman law, a document was valid only when the addressee had received it, and it is thus ready to take effect. Some Jewish texts were given to citing fantastically large numbers of people. They listed more slain in one battle than all the people who have lived in history. More reasonably, such texts estimated even larger numbers of angels. 10,000 was the largest single number used in Greek. So 10,000s of 10,000s, myriads of myriads, is the author's way of calling them innumerable. So next time you have a trivia question, what's the largest number known in Greek? You will know. 10,000.
Anything more than that is just a whole lot.
Yeah. Can't count more than 10,000. And finally, this scene set in the throne room of God functions like the epic council of the gods, where events are determined in a celestial world to be enacted on earth. The sequence of the chapter is as follows. The problem is posed as to who is worthy to open the seals on the scroll that reveals the future. The problem is solved when Christ, the Lamb, is declared worthy to open the seal. The elders around the throne respond with praise to the Lamb, and the rest of the heavenly hosts likewise praise the worthiness of the Lamb. So that's the basic outline of this particular chapter. Again, John is, and God is revealing to John, and John is using words that are familiar to the people of that time. The Council of the Gods, you know, you see that in Greek mythology, Roman mythology, Mesopotamian mythology, all of these ancient mythologies. So it's not unusual for God to use that same imagery to depict what's happening in heaven, and for John to use to recognize that and to describe it, what he saw as such. So again, this is literary. It doesn't mean that this is what is happening exactly in heaven.
John saw a council of the gods.
Yeah. So, going on into the passage, into this chapter, a little more into detail, verse 1, a scroll. And where does that scroll imagery come from? It comes from Ezekiel chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. Ezekiel, where is Ezekiel? And this chapter, Ezekiel chapter 2, is about Ezekiel's call from God. And I'm just going to start at verse 8. But you, son of man, hear what I say to you. Be not rebellious like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and eat what I give you. And when I looked, behold, a hand was stretched out to me, and behold, a scroll of a book was in it. Just, you know, note that the scroll and book are mentioned together there. A scroll of a book. And he opened it, and he spread it before me, and it had writing on the front and on the back. And there were written on it words of lamentation and mourning and woe. So in Ezekiel, it mentions this scroll that is written on both the front and the back. It's given by God to Ezekiel. Some of the differences between what's found in Ezekiel and Revelation is that in Ezekiel, the scroll is not sealed, it's open. And, you know, we don't know exactly what's on the book or the scroll that's in Revelation yet. But in Ezekiel, the contents are words of lamentation, mourning, and woe, indicative of some kind of judgment. This scroll in Revelation now is in the right hand of God. And the right hand of God typically represents God's power. And that's noted in Exodus, Psalm, and Isaiah as in the notes. So the point of verse 1 is that God determines the being who will be able to open the scroll. No one else is going to take it from God is the one who's going to give it to whoever is worthy. Verse 2, a mighty angel appears. And perhaps this is an allusion to Daniel chapter 4, where in this chapter Nebuchadnezzar had been wandering about, or Nebuchadnezzar has, in his pride, says, I have built the city of Babylon. And he has a dream about a large tree where the tree is cut down and a stump left. And as the story continues, Nebuchadnezzar is on the walls of Babylon, and he looks over and says, in his pride, says, I have built this city, and God's judgment falls. Nebuchadnezzar goes insane, and he is sent out away from the city into the field where he eats grass like a cow. But as in the dream, the stump is left. Therefore, there is still something there from which a shoot can begin to grow. And after, I believe it was 7 years, Nebuchadnezzar returns to his sanity. And he is reinstated as king. So the dream is about judgment, but it's also about this idea that there's something left from which life can return. Back to Revelation, chapter 5, verses 3 and 4. So no one is able to open the scroll or even look into it. Now, as far as this drama goes, this builds dramatic tension and suspense. Because this scroll, you see this scroll in the right hand, it's at the center of the stage. And this mighty angel proclaims, well, who is able to open it? And the answer is, no one. No one. So the audience is left catching their breath, wondering, well, holding their breath, wondering, well, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? Verse 5, one of the elders then says, there is someone. There is someone who can open it. And he gives this description. It's a messianic description. The Lion of Judah comes from Genesis chapter 49, where Jacob is blessing all of his 12 sons, giving blessings, and to Judah, he describes Judah as a lion, and he describes Judah as being eventually the one to rule over his brothers, where he will be given the scepter, and it will never leave the hand of Judah. And this idea of a lion as king and the tribe of Judah is picked up in later Jewish messianic expectations found in the Qumran scrolls, the different extra-biblical Jewish writings such as Jubilees, Testament of Simeon, Testament of Judah, and also in in writings that are after in the first century, like the fourth book of Ezra. I suppose it might be interesting to note that John himself does not use this imagery as a lion again in Revelation. So this is a unique description right here. What's important to note, perhaps, is that a lion has the power and fits the imagery of a conqueror. A lion was considered the most powerful animal at that time. So it has this powerful imagery. The root of David comes from Isaiah chapter 11. A shoot will grow from the stump of Jesse, a branch from his roots will bear fruit. And Jeremiah 2 picks up this thought of the root of David in his writings. Both are then applied to messianic expectations. They are descriptions of the Jewish Messiah. And of course, following Jesus, the Christians would apply the same imagery to Jesus. And so these descriptions for the Christians then would identify Jesus as this Lion of Judah, the root of David, who has conquered. Okay? Jesus was already described as having the key of David in chapter 3, so more descriptions of Jesus are being given as this book progresses. The elder does not say that the lion is worthy, but it is implied because he has conquered. So something about the idea of conquering has made Jesus worthy to open the scroll. And Jesus himself says that he had conquered towards the end of chapter 3. And this meaning of conquered is about to be revealed. In verse 6, I saw. John says, I saw. And it's an indication that something new is about to be revealed. Now, given what's come up to this point, the audience would be expecting to see a lion appear in the middle of the stage. But
because the lion is the one who's supposed to be there.
Yeah, that's what was just described by the elder. But the reality is that it is a lamb appearing as though it had been slain. Hardly the sight of a conquering creature. It's a dramatic reversal, it's a surprise. The word translated lamb is Greek arnion, which can mean either lamb, a young sheep, or a ram, a mature male sheep. And perhaps both meanings are intended in this passage. Because throughout, the idea of a sacrificial lamb, it refers to the Passover lamb. Obviously a yearling, a small, still lamb. But as this description of this lamb continues in chapter 5, we see that it has horns, which cannot be indicative of a young lamb. It's an older, mature ram. 7 horns. So, dual meaning, it's fine. This is fantastic imagery. It doesn't represent reality. Has 7 horns. 7 is, again, it indicates completeness, totality. Horns themselves represent power in the Bible, particularly in its ability to defeat enemies. 7 eyes comes from Zechariah chapter 4, and John has already alluded to this in previous chapters, such as chapter 4, verse 5. It appears as though it had been slain, and this refers to some of the messianic prophecies in regards to what the Messiah is going to do, look like when he appears. Isaiah chapter 53, which is one of the famous chapters, messianic chapters, where it describes the Messiah not as a conquering king, but a suffering servant. So, again, this dramatic tension. So, you see this lamb appear, and the audience is still wondering, so where is the lion? Where is the lion who is going to take this scroll and open it? The commentary reads here that the remarkable fact is that the slain lamb is one and the same as the conquering lion. The implications of this fact are enormous. First, the reader is given an important key for understanding the book. What John hears and what John sees may appear to be different, but that is not necessarily the case. in chapter 1, verse 10, John hears a voice. In chapter 1, verse 13, he sees one like a son of man. In chapter 5, verse 5, John hears conquering lion. In verse 6, he sees slain lamb. Second, the principle of non-literal revelation is confirmed once and for all. This is not a literal lion. Third, the astonishing juxtaposition of a conquering lion with a slain lamb can only be intended to indicate how Jesus in fact conquered by being slain. And the fact that the slain lamb is standing, in other words, alive, reminds the reader of Jesus' self-identification as the one who died but is now alive. Then verse 7, the question that the audience is holding is answered. The lamb goes to the one on the throne and takes from him the scroll. And the audience realizes that the lamb is the lion. Verse 8, new action takes place. The focus of the scene shifts from the throne in the center to the creatures and the elders. Both the creatures and the elders fall down before the Lamb. Earlier in chapter 4, verse 10, only the elders fell down before the being on the throne, but now the creatures, as well as the elders, are falling down before the Lamb. And these elders are given additional characteristics. One is that they hold harps, and they have golden bowls of incense. This holding a harp alludes to the Old Testament priesthood, where some of the priests were designated as musicians, and they were given harps. And the incense in these bowls represents prayers of the saints, as John interprets in verse 8 itself, but it is also an allusion to what's found in the Old Testament, such as Psalm chapter 141. So these elders are representing in some way a priesthood. They're representing priests. And now the psalm changes. Now, what they've been singing up to this point, you might say, is an old song.
Yeah.
Something that they've sung throughout all eternity. But now they sing a new song. And they sing this song together. And this new song explicitly identifies the lamb now as worthy to open the scroll, whereas earlier the elders only described the lion as one having conquered and thus is able to open the scroll. Now this song identifies this lamb as being worthy to open the scroll. And the song describes why the lamb is worthy. First, the lamb was slain. Second, the lamb ransomed through his blood a people for God. And thirdly, this lamb made these ransomed people a kingdom and priests for God. And if this scroll, as part of its characteristics, is perhaps some kind of a will and a testament, then it goes without saying that, you know, someone has to die in order for it to be opened. And the idea that the lamb was slain makes them worthy would then logically follow. And I believe the letter to the Hebrews, the epistle to the Hebrews, also gives similar ideas in regards to this whole idea of why this inheritance. Did it say Hebrews? think it's Galatians, where it talks about this inheritance that God makes available requires some kind of a blood. It might be Hebrews. Can't remember now. The inheritance is that it's God Himself, you might say. It's through His blood, Lamb ransomed through His blood a people for God, people belonging to God. And because of that, they are able to now be a kingdom, and they are priests for God. And the result of this is that this kingdom of priests will reign on the earth. Which is interesting because up to this point, everything has been about heaven. It was the idea of conquering and heaven went together, but now, ultimately, it's not about heaven, but it's about this earth. And this is, John is foreshadowing what is going to be described in the end of Revelation, where ultimately it's not about Christians all going to heaven and having harps and playing their harps on the clouds forever and ever and ever. It's about coming to a newly restored earth. So what about this scroll? Scroll and book are the same thing. In Revelation, the same Greek word is translated both ways, biblion. And in Revelation, biblion is used most frequently in association with the Book of Life. So, does the connection between this reading from a commentary, does the connection between the Lamb's right to take the scroll and His death give a clue as to the content of the scroll? Since the Lamb is deemed worthy to take the scroll and open its seals because He purchased people for God, does it not follow that the scroll must have something to do with these very people? What scroll used in judgment would be associated with those who will not be harmed by it? Certainly not a scroll containing their sins. But what about a scroll containing their names? In other words, the Book of Life, which has already been mentioned in chapter 3, verse 5. Indeed, it is precisely by virtue of having purchased them through His death that their names are in the Book of Life.
So does the will... So are we willed to God, or is God willed to us? What does that will say?
Good question. But it would sound like, obviously, because
we and God are willed to each other.
No, the New Testament imagery goes both ways. Mm-hmm. We belong to God and God belongs to us. Mm-hmm. It's an imagery of relationship rather than possession.
Mm-hmm. We and God are both willed in a relationship.
Yeah, so I think that's an important, a key concept is that the scroll or this book that John is going to mention frequently is the book of life. It contains the names of those who are redeemed, those who are saved.
How did he steal that list from Santa? Which is another kind of, you know, irony of our cultural stories coming out of this this story. You know, we have this entity carries around a list of virtue, basically, and you know, this is basically. I like that. You know, he's ransomed all people, you know, far and wide. And that's why that parchment or book is written on both sides, is because it contains the names of all.
I think it's important. One of the things about that written on both sides is that there are, you know, often I think it's been said or taught that only a few people are going to get saved.
There's a set number.
But what we see in chapter 5 is that, you know, if in fact this scroll is the book of life, it's written on both sides, there are so many people saved that they didn't just fit onto one side.
Yeah, it's a proclamation of the fact.
It's overflowing.
Yeah, that God's grace envelops all life, not just those that know Him, quote unquote.
Yeah, just as a reference, going forward all the way to chapter 20 of Revelation, verse 12 reads, "And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books, biblion, were opened." So there are multiple books. Then another book, biblion, was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the books, according to what they had done. So there are multiple books. When it comes to determining, you know, why a person is not redeemed, it's because of their own deeds. When it comes to who is redeemed, doesn't have anything to do with what that person has done or not done. It has everything to do with what Jesus has done.
You can reject the gift yourself by your own things that you say and do, by simply rejecting. But you can't get it yourself.
Maybe more like the redemption is only caused by what Jesus did, and our relationship with God is our way to that redemption. Like, there's no way that redemption was ever possible before our relationship through Jesus, in other words. Like, there's no way that man could create that redemption on his own. His judgment is in his own. His judgment of what his relationship with God is his own. But he cannot create the redemption that Christ has made for him.
God has adopted us, He's died for us, and in His will, He has declared that we now have redemption willed to us. Not something we earned, but simply He willed it to us and declared that it's ours. Okay. I like the idea of it being aware.
So after that song, verses 11 and 12, so we have the creatures and the elders, in the new song. In verses 11 and 12, the angels join in yet another song. The new song that was immediately prior was in the second person. In other words, you directed toward the Lamb. You are worthy. This song that the angels join in is in the third person, speaking of the Lamb. And the number of angels could be an allusion to Daniel chapter 7, this whole idea of myriads and myriads, thousands of thousands, an innumerable, uncountable number of angels. And what this song describes is that this Lamb, in addition to being worthy to take the scroll, is also worthy of heavenly praise. And in verses 13 and 14, after the following the angels, all of creation joins in the song of praise to the Lamb and to the one on the throne. Emphasizing once again, as it has so many times so already in Revelation, Jesus and God are equal. Now from 4 to 24 to 28 to myriads of angels to all of creation, and this huge chorus joining in. It's a dramatic crescendo. You might, if you imagine kind of a musical, go from a solo to a small chorus to a larger chorus to the entire cast joining in.
Singing all together.
Yeah.
Maybe even the entire audience.
Perhaps.
Okay. The audience.
Yeah. And then it dramatically ends with the four living creatures saying, Amen. Meaning, these four living creatures indicate complete agreement with everything that all creation is saying about the Lamb. And the elders fall down in worship. Once again, the emphasis is that Jesus is God. So here we are now being given a peek in dramatic form into how heaven is responding to what was described happening on earth in the seven letters. It's all about Jesus. Jesus is the most powerful being in the universe. Here, in a limited earthly perspective, it may not feel that way. It may not seem that way. For the recipients of Revelation, it might have felt like the iron grip of Rome, the Roman emperor. Was the most powerful being. But John is reminding his audience that there is an unseen reality above all that can be seen on this earth. And in that unseen reality, Jesus is more powerful than even the Roman emperor. Another point that John is making related to the first point is that Jesus is the only one able to grant life. From a limited Roman Empire perspective, it was the emperor who held the key to life and death for any person, citizen, free, or slave living in his domain.
But then when you see this amazing musical going on above your head, then it makes the story ever so much bigger.
Yeah. And I think if this scroll is the book of life, then it is particularly telling that when John searches for anyone who can open it on earth or in heaven, earth and below, there is no one. There is no one. And that includes the Roman Emperor.
Well, they've talked about that before also with the I am the ruler but not the creator when the Emperor speaks, because John is really trying to point out here that there might be somebody here of a great stature but still not of the ability to tailor the universe in a whole.
So this chapter pictures Jesus as the only being who is able to truly give life. Like a broken record, John emphasizes Jesus is God. And this is the scene. This scene is the lens through which the rest of Revelation should be read. And this whole picture of Jesus as being the supreme power, who is able to grant life, who holds, who has already created a kingdom of priests for God. That is the spiritual reality. So it is with that setting that the act of the scroll with the seven seals continues. And now, one after another, the seals are open to reveal something.
Oh, the anticipation.
Well, yeah, there you go with that. Now that the recipient of the will has been established, it can now be read and shown what the recipient is eligible toward or what has happened to the estate, basically.
I think what has happened more typically in interpretations of the seven seals in the past is we've tended to ignore chapters 4 and 5.
Yeah.
We focused on the scroll and the seven seals itself, but kind of overlooked the overall setting.
Just because it doesn't really make sense.
Or it seems maybe a little irrelevant. Mm-hmm. What does all that have to do with it?
Fantastical.
Yeah. Because really, there's not a whole lot of interesting doctrine in 4 and 5. It's just setting a scene.
So what is in fact? Wow.
But there's a very deep seated doctrine there that's more relevant to all of this than any of it that's available later, is that the fact that all who have responded to the life that Jesus has given are eligible to receive the judgment and glory that Christ is capable of. And the part we skip over.
Yeah, for those who are redeemed, ransomed, who are part of the kingdom of God, have nothing to fear from the scroll. Now, the contents of the scroll is life for them. as we continue on, it's going to get this opening the scrolls, the seals of the scrolls, and reading from the scroll is very dark. It's judgment. But it's nothing. No, it depends on which side of God a person is on.
Right. It's kind of like how you would think of a family sitting at a table and thinking, well, you know, no one person knows exactly what the other was really doing, but they all know what they did, and they all have to sit and kind of wonder, well, you know, the honor of our family is being passed down at this point. Mm-hmm. Who is going to be set with the responsibility of carrying on the honor of the family? And, you know, there's always that anticipation of whether or not you were worthy enough to receive that honor to continue it and to keep it going. And it's, you know, I mean, in more layman's terms, it's like, do I get the car or do I get the actual house itself, you know, or something like that. It's you know, or do I get a swift
for
kick?
For people who heard this that didn't know all the comparisons and all the symbols that go back, I bet this is confusing. I just can't even imagine trying to understand it without knowing where it goes back to.
Well, for hundreds of years, people have been saying, oh, Revelation is just weird, bizarre stuff.
It is.
You can't understand.
Well, from what my contemporary attitude and idea of it is that for years people have been telling me that the Bible is schizophrenic because here you have all of this, everybody loves each other, New Testament, and then right there at the end it's like, oh, but wait a minute, you're all going to die.
Scary.
You know, and so you know, for years that's what I've been kind of gathered and been told is that, you know, well, it's...
Looking at
this is all good right here, but disregard this part of the end.
Looking at it through the theatrical part makes it make a lot more sense.
as opposed to
just
all
realistic.
Just don't read the last page.
Yeah. Ignore the parts that are...
Enjoy the book, but don't read the last page because you won't like the end.
That's kind of how it's been introduced to me in the past. Is just, you know, especially with the like non-denominational or non-doctrinal points of view. You know, with people that really want to just have a happy existence and just love each other, quote unquote. Religion or whatever you want to call it, they have always kind of steered away from that because they just don't want people to they don't want to have to try to explain the hard part, you know, like no, it's all okay, you're loved, that's all you need to know. And so I think this is amazing because it's being broke down in a way that it shows that there really is actually a line, a defined place that you need to be in, because that's where those people fall into that acceptance of everything, you know, of it's okay to be who this, that, and we'll all just love each other. There's no judgment in our own mind to make a decision to stay on that side there with God. And so this gives us the opportunity to see that there's an actual will that is written for us to follow. It's not a very detailed one. It's not very, you know, there is only really one thing that does matter, but it is there. Yeah, pretty neat.